Welcome, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of the Startup Speaker Series. I'm really excited to see you all here with us. And I'm very excited about our guest today. I think she's going to be someone that you can relate to. She got her start young. So she is, yeah, you can see how you can walk in her footsteps, hopefully. So today we have Erica Hairston. So she has recently been named one of the 30 under 30 for Forbes education list. She is also one of the youngest Black women to raise more than $1 million. So I like those elite kind of standing. So it's nice to be able to introduce you with that. Erica, can you tell us, so take us a little bit back to college. What was college like for you? What did you think you were going to do? What were your goals?
Yeah, so it's nice to meet everyone. Thank you, Dawn, for that very nice introduction. As Dawn mentioned, I'm Erica Hairston, and I'm the co-founder and CEO of EdLift, a startup that helps college students and adult learners through like really tough engineering courses. And so if I were to go back to when I was in college and what I thought I was going to do, I had no idea that I would be running a company. I grew up, you know, in a house that taught you, you go to college, you get a good job, and you stay there for many years, and you make as much as you can, and you work for someone else. And I always kind of joke that I had an advisor and a mentor who, like, not too different from Aaron and Dawn here, who was in my ear kind of reminding me every year of college that, like, you can have the audacity to build your own company. There are different ways to create impact, and it doesn't need to be working for someone else. And so originally I thought I was going to be a product manager at a big company. That was what I was aiming for. And actually that was my first job out of college. But while I was in school, I kept tinkering with things and building things on my own, and eventually realized I can do this as a full-time job. So originally it was a product manager is what I thought I wanted to do.
Awesome. So what were some of these things you were tinkering with? What were you building while you were in college?
Yeah, so I was a computer science major and a double major in African American studies. And so I spent like internships as a software engineering intern. And it actually wasn't until my senior year of college, so I was a bit late, where for my like senior project, you could actually like do whatever you wanted. And so I was kind of wanting to solve a problem for myself, which was I wanted to be able to see more underrepresented role models. So like if I was from the Midwest and I wanted to see an astrophysician, like how would I be able to find that person? And so I actually taught myself like iOS engineering. I used a Udacity course and a Udemy course and Stanford's free YouTube classes to teach myself how to build an app. And it actually turned out some of my friends were like, oh, like crap, I want to use this. Like, can I download it on my phone? How can I use it? And so that was honestly the first time that I had like built something. And I realized I'm actually solving a need that other people have as well. And I can create something of value. And so I started off as just something I was doing for class and solving a problem for myself. And then over time, it actually became my first startup, and was featured by the Apple like App Store a few times, which is very cool. So that was like my first startup that started off as a class project.
That's an awesome story. I love it. I love it. Yeah. So you were getting a lot out of your college experience.
Yeah.
So definitely. How did you get to EdLift? So tell us your founding story for EdLift. Where did the idea come from and when did it become more than just an idea?
Yeah, so basically where EdLift started is honestly my like senior year of high school. So I actually thought I wanted to be an ambassador. I like wanted to travel and do like international affairs in college is what I initially thought I was passionate about. And then I saw a documentary. It was actually by like a women's engineering club, I think at Stanford, by She++. And they talked about how few like women and minorities pursue technology. And they also showed like Facebook's campus and like how, you know, computer science is in everything you use. And I just remember watching that and thinking like, holy smokes, how could there be so few people who look like me in this industry that's clearly going to be the future? Like I have to try it. And my mom always jokes, she's like, I spent 18 years trying to get you interested in STEM and it took this one documentary to do it. But it was perfect timing. And that's how I ended up as a freshman in university pursuing the computer science major. However, when I took that first engineering class, and maybe some of you students might relate to this, I felt like I was getting punched in the face multiple times. It was so hard. It was definitely an uphill battle. But despite it feeling so tough, I actually really liked being able to create something that was just an idea in my head and turn it, you know, into fruition. And so the moment that really clicked for me, so even though I almost dropped out of the CS major so many times, the summer after my freshman year, I got my first internship offer, and it was from Facebook, and it was for as much as my parents were making, if not more, which, you know, for a 19-year-old, you're like, holy smokes, again,
that's a lot.
In my mind, that's a lot, right? And that was really the like aha moment where I realized, you know, this is how you create economic opportunity for people. I want to devote my life to helping more people have access to these in-demand fields. So that was honestly the true, like, you know, founder story. And so my senior year of college, that app that I had created for class was to help people find role models to get into these industries. And a lot of the people who are using that app actually happen to be college students. And so I ended up talking to our users. So I just talked to the people who were using the app who happened to be college students. And what we kept hearing them say was, this is, you know, inspiring and impactful, but if you truly want to help make the biggest difference in my career, I need help getting through these really tough engineering classes. And so one of my good friends from high school, she actually had a similar experience with computer science at Stanford. And we kind of reconnected and realized, like, that's where we can make the biggest impact. Let's, you know, pivot Zamella, so that was the app that we started off with, into EdLift, and let's do what we did for ourselves in college, but help way more students get through their really hard computer science classes. And so that's where we are today in terms of how EdLift came to be.
That's fantastic. Love the story. Thank you for sharing.
Yeah.
Now, I'm curious about this fundraising success that you had. Because you, as I said before, you were one of the youngest Black women to raise more than $1 million. I can imagine it could feel exciting, but also a little disappointing that not more people have done it, right? I don't know.
Yeah, so it's funny too, because if you were to do the math, our fundraising actually started in March of 2020, which was probably the worst time to begin fundraising or to honestly be doing anything. I know a lot of people were trying to get married and weddings and graduations, but everything stopped. And we launched our fundraise, literally the week before, I think, lockdown started. And so when I think of our fundraising journey, my identity actually comes second to COVID in terms of what impacted the experience. But yeah, so I guess, was your question kind of like, what did that feel like to do the fundraising?
Yeah, tell me what it felt like.
Yeah, so we were very privileged in that we actually did an accelerator. So Y Combinator, I don't know how many people are familiar with it, but it's the top like startup accelerator probably in the world, like DoorDash and Stripe and whatnot, all Airbnb came through them. And so we had just finished their accelerator from January to March, and they're known for really helping startups like raise a significant amount of funding at the end of the accelerator in March. However, for our batch, that was a little bit different because, you know, COVID hit and no one knew what to expect. And so for us, like what that journey looked like was honestly just, you know, getting beat up a little bit. It was hearing a lot of no's. It was learning how to tell your story, like while the rest of the world is in chaos. And just having to be like super resilient. And that was probably the thing that like helped me get through it. So we actually fundraised from like March to June. And I probably reached out to over 400 like investors during that process. And I've definitely heard over 300 no's. And it was this process of just getting really, really confident in the fact that we are the best ones to solve this problem and helping other people see that. Was the key learning there. And when we closed it, it was honestly the best feeling in the world. It didn't feel real because I remember so many moments where I thought maybe we can't do it. The fact that, you know, 0.001% of Black women have raised funding, like I'm not special. We aren't going to get there. And I remember having that kind of moment, but every morning I woke up, I remembered, no, like we are the best ones to do this and I have to just keep trying. And so that's kind of what led us to closing the round.
That's fantastic. I love that attitude that led to your resilience, knowing that you were the best people to solve the problem. Where does that confidence come from? How do you know that it's you, that this is your problem to solve?
Yeah, so I think it really helps when you are building a company that solves a problem you've experienced yourself. And so I just literally, I have a journal from my experience in college where some of the lines in there are like, this is so lonely. I feel like I'm so bad at computer science. Like, I think I should just give up. And then literally the next line is like, no, you have to keep going because you're doing this for more than just yourself. Like, I wanted to be the role model that I wish I had in computer science. And so having literally my own words telling me why this problem is important to solve was my constant reminder that, like, you've experienced this and you know how to get through it because you've done it already and you can do it for more people. And so going back to my why is the thing that helped me remain confident even when other people couldn't see our vision.
Wonderful. And with meeting 400 different investors, I'm sure you had to do that a number of times. I have another question just about some of the differences in or what you learned from your experiences working for places like Facebook and LinkedIn. So do you think that you were influenced by your time spent at those companies? And if so, yeah. How?
That's a great question. So I'll first start with LinkedIn. I'm a huge fan of LinkedIn. If I wasn't running my own company, I would probably work there for the rest of my life. And the biggest lesson that I learned from my time there is they have one of their company values is relationships matter. And it sounds like, oh, it's like a cute, you know, corporate phrase or whatever, but no, like they truly live by the mantra, their value that the people you work with, you need to invest in those relationships. And what that looked like is having a manager who literally would tell me, like, I trust you. You can make the right decision here. And if you need help, I have your back. And like to have a manager who's that excellent and empowers you to trust your gut and make hard decisions, I think is probably the top thing that I took with me to building my own company is I want to be a manager that empowers other people. And I want to create a company culture where relationships truly are like the top value. So that's by far like the first most important thing I learned is I kind of took notes from LinkedIn around like, why is this such a great place to work? What makes this company so excellent? And how can I build those values into my own company? And then in terms of like tactical skills, honestly, like how a company runs, like that sounds so simple, but there's moments where you're like, how does a meeting work? Like, how do these processes work? Where I'll literally go back to, okay, well, I know we pushed out features after having a design sprint and, you know, learning literally how we launched features at LinkedIn and implementing that within our own company. And so it gets literally that tactical. So this is how we wrote a spec for a new feature. This is how we communicated about deadlines. And so there were a lot of little things that I learned from working at these big tech companies. However, on the flip side, I think there was almost more unlearning that I had to do. Because when you work at these big companies that have thousands of employees, things move a lot slower. It has to go through many checks and balances. And that's actually what makes startups so valuable, is when they're smaller, you can move faster and you're always talking to your users. And that's why, like, a company like Airbnb can beat, you know, big hotel brands because they were able to ship things so quickly. And that's your greatest advantage. And so I needed to unlearn, you know, needing to have a perfect pitch deck to persuade a team that we should invest in this new feature. Like, no, talk to a user the next day, build a broken version of it to get the idea out, get feedback, and constantly iterate on it. And so that was honestly the biggest unlearning that I had to do is ship before you're ready, ship fast, and talk to your users more often.
Wonderful. Now, so I'm curious about the unlearning of the, or getting to the point where you're shipping fast and where you're shipping broken things. I expect, you know, knowing a little bit about your background and some of your achievements, that it would be difficult to not put out something that's polished and quote unquote ready. How do you make that leap to get there?
Yeah, honestly, it's the hardest thing in the world. I think there's a famous quote that's like, if you wait to ship something like when you think it's ready, you shipped it too late. And I'm a perfectionist. It's something that I've been like trying to fight, and especially women actually tend to like try to perfect things more than men, is a fact. And so knowing that, first becoming self-aware was like the key thing that I had to do, is know that I over-prepare too often. And once I knew that about myself, then I constantly question like, is this necessary to get what I need? And so I work backwards from like, what's the goal? And I work backwards to what's the minimal thing that I can put out there to learn or to get what I needed to get out of this. And so constantly asking myself those two questions allows me to feel more confident putting out something that I think might not be, you know, perfect yet. And also just acknowledging that there never is perfect. And the fact that things will always need to be improved. And so you're actually doing yourself a disservice by waiting too long to get feedback, because the longer you wait, the more that you might have to change and the more energy that you put into something that might not have been correct. And so that has actually always been my like key, like North Star that I follow, is I want to get feedback on this like soon as possible so that I waste as little time and put something in front of our users that I know that they'll actually see they were a part of building because they gave me feedback when it was at its earliest stage.
I love it. So Erica, in my next class on Tuesday, we're talking about MVPs. So I'm going to throw out some of your words as this expert advice that I was given. So.
That's awesome. Yes, MVPs are the key to everything. It's honestly one of the biggest, I think, misconceptions about running a startup. So like Y Combinator, they get, you know, hundreds of thousands of applications a year. And I think a lot of people expect like, oh, the companies that get in, they must have like had a fully, you know, built out application and a website and all of these like really complex things. Like I know people who got in with a product that was nothing but a Google form, a Zoom link, and Slack. Like that was the product, was those three things. And it was a true MVP that users were paying money because they were solving a really important problem for them. So if you're solving a core problem, it doesn't matter how you're doing it in the earliest stages. An MVP can truly be a Google form, as long as it's, you're doing like really hacky things behind the scenes to make the magic happen as a solution.
I love it. Love it. Yes, I'm going to have to get this clip. Aaron, you have a question.
Yeah, Eric, I wanted to follow up on this idea of like building something imperfect and getting it out there. I'm curious if you ever feel a tension, or if it ever comes up where you're balancing like improving the thing that maybe isn't perfect versus like building the next thing. Like, you know, did imperfect products like compound and build on each other? And is that ever a problem, or are you just moving so fast that it, you know,
yeah,
a week later, it's too late to even worry about that anymore?
That's a great question. I think there, we're still kind of going back and forth on like what actually needs to be improved versus when do you make a big bet. And so for us, I think what we've learned from like our advisors and different founders is that every company kind of has its own set of like key values. So for example, like Apple, I think is on the other extreme, right? Like they're super design focused. They don't launch anything until like they know it's absolutely perfect to be put out there, and like user empathy and user design is their top value. So they're on the total other side of the spectrum. Whereas for us, the way we see it is, what is the thing that we can put out that creates the most impact for our students or for our users? And if that thing is, okay, well, if we make this one tweak to this thing that we know is like not working well, 80% more of our students will be, you know, doing 100% better versus like, let's spend, you know, 2 months building this new thing that we're not sure, you know, might work. In that case, we will always go for the thing that will have the biggest impact. And so the metrics that we use to determine which to focus on are like, how much will it help us achieve our goal, and how much time will it take us to build? And we use those two factors to stack rank, okay, an improvement or new bet, an improvement and a new bet. And one kind of like hack that we've recently done, which has worked super well for us, is if we have a new feature bet that, you know, we can build something new, grow really fast, we ask ourselves always, how can we build an MVP of this and get feedback in 1 week? And we give ourselves literally 1 week to design something that we can start to learn like how, what that impact will be before we put engineering effort behind it. And so we're always able to launch a lot of things quickly, even if it's like a big bet, because we're thinking about the MVP version of it.
Thank you.
Great question,
Aaron. Super helpful.
So I'm curious about some more experience stories. So being an entrepreneur, people make it sound like it's a really, really sexy gig. What are some of the most exciting moments that you've had as an entrepreneur?
Yeah. So it's funny. I think, yeah, there's a lot of exciting moments. And then there's moments where it's like, wow, no one tells you this is like the real experience of being an entrepreneur. Like, this is not sexy, but it is very... accurate of what it's like being an entrepreneur is I remember we were trying to figure out our like accounting, and I just remember sitting there and being like, I have no idea how to do this, but I'm gonna figure it out. And I was watching these like YouTube videos by an accountant around like how to categorize your expenses, and I never pictured myself as like that's part of the job of being a startup founder. So that's an unsexy experience, but in terms of like the big moment, so I think for us the first one is when we got like our first paying customer. There's nothing like spending months, you know, thinking about how this thing is going to play out in the world and like, will it actually work? And for us, actually, the way we got our first users is we stood outside of classrooms at universities for CS classes, and we would just like talk to students about their experiences. And I just remember we talked to one student who was like, oh my God, I need you. Like, I need this. And, you know, a couple of days later when she joined Edlift, it was just a huge moment for us because it was validating to see that this idea that we had no idea if it would work, is actually solving a problem for someone. So getting our first customer was like the first big exciting win. And then obviously closing our fundraise, because it was a month long process of just constantly literally waking up every morning to another investor saying, it's not a good fit, or due to the financial climate in COVID, that can feel really demoralizing. And then all of a sudden you're seeing more and more yeses and investors you are really excited about. So like the CEO of LinkedIn, Jeff Weiner, is one of our investors, and Kleiner Perkins, like people I never would have imagined on our cap table joining. So that is like the other end of the excitement and super sexy. And then obviously, of course, like being featured by Forbes. I never pictured that, especially not, we're such a young company. And I really appreciated the fact that they highlighted the mission behind our company. It was less about, look at these people who raised $1 million. And it was more about, they're trying to close the gender gap in STEM. And like, that's why we do what we do. And people joining the journey and what we're trying to achieve in the world and how we want to make it a better place. So those would be like two exciting moments.
I like those exciting moments. Why don't you talk a little bit more about that, why you do what you do and what it is that you actually do?
Yeah, so I was actually telling Aaron a little bit before this, before the students joined, kind of the story behind why Edlift exists is truly the fact that when people have the capabilities to create their own ideas, it just unlocks this like huge kind of like open space where you have the ability to do whatever you want and create solutions for the problems you've experienced. And when I first learned about, you know, like how few women and minorities were in tech, I realized like, wow, you know, women have very unique problems, like underrepresented groups have very unique problems. And if we're not building, if we don't have the tools or the expertise to build those solutions, who's going to be building them for us? And there's so many things that make people unique and so many unique problems that people from different backgrounds have that there needs to be a solution that helps more people have access to learn these skills. And so the reason we started Edlift is we wanted to create a world where, you know, everyone has that one skill or one subject that like really scares them. I think for a lot of people, it's like orgochemistry is like, oh my God, I can never do that. And we know Edlift is successful. Our vision is that when you look back, you would thought it was absurd that you ever couldn't do that. You know, like that's how we know Edlift is successful. That's our vision, is, you know, you can get through that really hard thing because you have this support system. And so what Edlift actually does in terms of like how our program works is we help college students and adult learners through these really tough computer science and STEM classes, where we hire a student mentor from their school who's aced their class, who will have these live help sessions every week with them. And they also have access to our like really cool study tools that you know, break down really complex like coding problems and things for them to help them process the class better and feel like they belong and feel confident. And so that's what we do and why we do what we do.
Wonderful, wonderful. Thank you for that. Now, Erica, you mentioned COVID and its impact on fundraising. I'm curious, since you launched so close to our life with the pandemic, do you see any, like, what kinds of things changed in your business model that maybe you wouldn't have done that way if you'd started when people were going to school live?
Yeah. So for one, actually, EdLift was in person initially. So mentors would literally meet at cafes on campus and like work with students that way. And so that shifted immediately, which turned out to be actually really good for us because it meant the like sessions were more accessible. They would be like recorded so people could go back and watch them. So that was like a core change in just how our like, you know, structure of our service worked. And then I would say like the other significant thing that shifted for us was kind of like what Amita asked, the way we found students changed. We weren't putting flyers on campus anymore. We were trying to be creative about digital marketing and our like digital strategy. And then what else would I say? I think I was very grateful during that time because I had a lot of founder friends, some who are working on like clothing exchange marketplaces or like hospitality things. And their companies just like plummeted. They lost all their users. Their entire industries, you know, went to the ground because of COVID. Whereas for us, we realized this was a moment where we could have even more impact because students were really struggling with online learning. And so we ended up launching like a scholarship program where anyone could buy a scholarship for someone to do EdLift, and we could support students from all backgrounds, regardless of their financial status and who are facing hardship. And so I think I just remember feeling very fortunate and even more kind of like, wow, our work truly matters because more students are going to be dropping out of engineering in this chaotic time, and we need to be there and ready to support them. So those would be the top three shifts.
I love that answer, especially that third piece. That's great perspective. So, all right, I have another emotion for you. So I asked about excitement before. I want to know about fear. What has been scariest in this journey? Tell us a story of something scary.
Yeah, so the first initial fear was starting the company. What I was going to say is there's like this false narrative around you kind of wake up one morning and you're like, I'm ready to start a company. Like that did not exist for me. I actually was working at LinkedIn for a full year, and I had mornings where I woke up and I was like, okay, I'm ready to do it. And then I got to work the next day and was like, oh my God, no, I love my salary. Like, I can't do that. And so the golden handcuffs are very real once you work in a company, and your network of people are all also working at a company. And so it feels crazy or, you know, extreme to leave and work somewhere and, you know, do your own thing. And so that was the first big moment of fear, is having confidence in myself and normalizing starting a company. And the thing that I did to get over that was I just built my network of founders and changed my perspective around like what was normal to get over that fear. And then the second, I think, big fear moment is just knowing you're working on the right thing. And it's kind of similar to what Aaron asked around like, how do you know? There's so many things you could be building. And my co-founder and I actually had like existential crisis mode in January, where we just kept going back and forth saying like, how do we know? Like, how do we know? And there was a lot of fear around like, we have all of this investor money, we have to return, value to them 10X. And the thing that got us over that fear was just remembering, again, we are the best ones to solve this problem. Talk to your users. And actually a lot of startup founders get to that, you know, existential crisis mode and forget, you know, why they need to build what they're building because they've gone 2 weeks without talking to your users. And that's how we navigated ourselves back, is just remembering to get really, really close to the problem. But those were the two big pivotal moments of fear.
Thank you for that, Erica. And we are almost at time. So please, everyone, join me in giving Erica a round of applause. Yay.
Thank you, everyone.
Really appreciated you. So thank you for taking the time to be with us and for sharing your stories and your wisdom.
So it was wonderful. Thank you for having me, Don and Aaron, and good luck with your projects, everyone.